What's up, Wildside besties and baddies? I'm Bailey.
And I'm Chelsea, and we're here to walk you through the wild sides.
From homicides to hosticides and everything in between.
We're so glad you're here, so buckle up
and enjoy the ride. Happy Wednesday.
Happy Wednesday to you. Y'all, it's interview week.
Interview week.
So, housekeeping, we have some exciting news, Bailey.
Yeah, so we finally got stickers for our merch. You guys, we got to take it slow. This has been a steep learning curve. We don't have sweaters and hats, and yet I am working on that with the bandwidth that I have. But for now, we've got cool stickers. Shout out to Kelly Steen, who designed them for us. Mm-hmm. One is our logo. The other one is our specially designed tarot card, the Wildsider. It's mm-hmm. pretty amazing. It's going to come in regular and holographic, so we're really excited about that.
It really is like the coolest sticker. I'm not into tarot cards, but this sticker is really cool. So this week, the interview is going to be with the one and only Dr. Everett Penn. And if you need a hero, like if you are like, I want my kid to have a hero in this life, Dr. Everett Penn is where it is at. Like,
yeah, he's the best.
The embedded criminologist for the Houston Police Department. He is also one of the professors of criminology at the University of Houston. And last but definitely not least, he created the TAPS Academy down in the Houston area. And it is such an amazing program. And their goal is to reduce the social distance between law enforcement and youth, particularly at-risk youth, but that is their mission. And they have done it in Houston. They've expanded nationwide, and it is absolutely incredible. I've actually been talking to our local law enforcement and school systems, and we're actually, you know, kind of possibly getting the ball rolling here. So
that's awesome.
I can't say enough about the program.
Yeah. And all of that being really great, but knowing that this is our interview week with Dr. Penn that has to do with, you know, police versus youth, primarily minority youth, mm-hmm. I imagine that this episode is going to fall in line per our system here. And I don't like it.
I don't like it at all. So as you guys know, we do single blind cases reporting, if you want to call it reporting, podcasting. So Bailey does not know the case. I don't know the case beforehand. So with a sigh, because y'all, this has kind of kept my stomach in a knot for multiple reasons. Bailey was like, are you okay? Are you sure you're good to do this case? And I was like, yes, I'm good. So without further ado, we are going to be covering the 1992 Los Angeles riots. Ooh. And Rodney King.
Oh, snap.
Oh. Y'all, I'm already getting teary-eyed. Like, I get really emotional over the weirdest stuff. And this case just makes me really emotional. Like, literally for everybody involved. This is so hard for me because it is just a very emotional case. I'm going to apologize if I get a little choked up here and there throughout the case. I'm going to try not to, but just please excuse if I do get a little emotional. But Bailey, do you know anything about any of this stuff?
I mean, obviously I know the name Rodney King. Obviously I know the name, the Los Angeles riots, but it happened when I was too little to understand what was going mm-hmm. on. And there has been enough time passed for it not to be a quote-unquote hot topic issue.
Right.
The little that I know about it is that it was kind of the first viral incident of police brutality in the United States. Or the first incident that was caught on camera and became viral.
Correct. Right. Yeah, it's definitely not something that we learn about in our history books. You know, like that's not part of our middle school, elementary school curriculum. So again, if you grew up in that era, you have heard the name, you've possibly heard, you know, either of Rodney King or the LA riots. So today we are going to be covering a lot of it. We're going to be covering a lot of things because you kind of can't cover one without the other. And I think that was what was most surprising to me about researching this case is I wanted it to the focal point to be Rodney King, since, again, we're talking about just police affairs and police relations with civilians. But I can't just cover Rodney King. So we're going to start at the end and we're going to work our way back.
Ooh, twist.
Yeah, we're going to start at the end and we're going to work our way back.
Let's do it.
So the Los Angeles riots lasted for only 6 days, from April 29th to May 4th, 1992. During a span of 6 days, there were 63 deaths, 2,300 injuries, 12,000 arrests, and an estimated 1,100 buildings were damaged, with a resulting grand total of $1 billion worth of damage.
Oh my goodness. I knew the LA riots were bad. That's all I knew, was like, this was a big thing and it was bad. Not like good versus evil bad. I just mean like,
it was really bad. Yeah. You know, we grew up in South Mississippi, so we understand damage being through, you know, we were Hurricane Katrina. You were down there during Hurricane Katrina. So we've been through hurricanes. We've been through natural disasters and seeing areas have, you know, millions or billions of dollars worth of damage because of a hurricane. But to try to envision $1 billion worth of man-made damage is really kind of mind-blowing. Okay. So the LA streets were rampaged with just widespread arson, looting, assault, vandalism. So the LA mayor at the time had to impose a dusk till dawn curfew, while the news coverage is just spreading images of enraged members of LA's South Central, Pico Union, and Koreatown neighborhoods, right? So the coverage is literally just the sky is bright orange at night. The smoke is out of control. There is looting local shops, dragging people from their vehicles, and the whole time chanting, no justice, no peace. I mean, it's like a scene out of a movie.
Well, I was literally going to say one of my favorite shows right now is SWAT. And I think one of their several string of their episodes in one of the seasons is flashbacks of Hondo, who's the main character. He was like a teenager during that time in Los Angeles when they had the riots. And they do flashbacks during that time. And I guess correlate to that is people being pulled out of cars, getting beat in the streets and throwing bricks, lighting things on fire and that kind of thing.
I mean, it was absolute anarchy. So in the midst of these riots, news stations would air Rodney King's plea for peace. And he would later be mocked for his heartfelt plea. So his big thing that I think all of us can probably remember if we grew up in this area, he said, people, I just want to say, you know, can we all get along? Right. And so that's where that, like, can't we all just get along? That's where that came from.
Oh, like the mocking of that?
Right, right. So that was Rodney King's plea on national television in the response to the Los Angeles riots. So the LAPD and other first responders struggled to contain the chaos that would eventually resolve after the California National Guard, the U.S. military, and upwards of 10,000 armed first responders were deployed to end the violence and the anarchy. So
this is like a city war.
It is. Oh, it's a full blown, like, what in the Mad Max is going on?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the LA riots would become the most destructive period of unrest and uprising in modern U.S. history.
Seriously?
Yeah. And that's, again, I'm like, how do I not know any of this stuff?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is it's like, of course, it's a tag name. Like, if you say Rodney King, most humans will be like, I know the name.
Yeah.
But as far as the details,
yeah,
this is...
And why don't I know about the LA riot? Like, why do I not know about this stuff? So there's an allegorical bomb that has been detonated in LA.
What is allegorical?
Kind of like theoretical, like not a literal bomb that was detonated.
Well, you threw an allegorical bomb at me just now with that word.
Like most volatile eruptions, there are multiple catalysts, but it's safe to say that the very man that they aired pleading for the violence to stop was the same man who would finally tip those scales and start the LA riots, which is Rodney King.
Well, he didn't start the LA riots. What happened to him started the LA riots.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. But I mean, it was Rodney King and what would happen to him. That was the final tipping point. That was kind of that straw that broke the camel's back for these South Central LA communities. Rodney Glenn King, here's another little fun fact. He never even went by Rodney. He went by Glenn all growing up.
Huh.
And so it was kind of funny. I read this one article and he was like, I didn't want to be Rodney King. Like, I literally was Glenn, you know, kind of meaning like I didn't want to be this person in the spotlight. And I that wasn't really even the name that I used. You know, I went by Glenn. Like, everybody knew me as
Interesting.
Glenn.
Interesting.
So he was born April 2nd, 1965 in Sacramento, California. And he was one of three boys of an, guess what type of family?
A blue-collar, working, hardworking family?
He had an abusive, alcoholic father.
Oh.
And a very loving, wonderful mother.
Okay.
King started drinking beer and smoking weed when he was 11 years old. And he, in his book, so I actually downloaded his book and have read through it, and it's just, I'm just a ball of emotions going through this thing. He was like, you know, some people have to acquire a taste for beer. He was like, not me. The first time that hit me, I thought, I've never tasted anything so good. And he was like, I was hooked from the age of 11. Smoking weed, drinking. During his high school years, King and his brothers would work overnight with his dad. His dad cleaned offices, office buildings, but they would usually be up there till like 2 o'clock in the morning, right? So he was up there working with his dad, and then he would go home, he'd sleep for a little bit, and then he would go to school. Because of King's lack of sleep, it was kind of interpreted as him being apathetic and possibly having learning disabilities. And in his book, he was like, I mean, I was just tired. Like, I was just really tired.
Literally, you know, we work with teenagers, and if they're grumpy or they're off, one of the first things I ask them is like, how many hours of sleep did you get last night? And 99% of the time it's like, oh, I didn't sleep good.
Right. What is that? That Maslow's hierarchy of need. It's like, did you get sleep and have you eaten?
Yeah.
And so because of this, they assumed that he had learning disabilities. And so they suggested that King be moved into a special education program. So he was put in with the special education kids. I mean, this is early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he was taunted. He was teased. He was bullied because of that. And on top of that, the only thing he really wanted to do was play sports. But because he was put in the special education program, he was not eligible to play sports.
Okay.
I'm so thankful that our school systems have evolved a bit, because that is wild to me. But he had a teacher, Mr. Jones, who, you know, he went to bat for him, and he was able to convince the school and to convince the leagues to let Rodney King play, right?
Yeah.
So Rodney was like, this dude was the best. He really went to bat for me. You know, what a great guy. And this great guy would also later go on to
sexually abuse him.
Yeah. Inappropriately.
How did I freaking know this?
Yeah.
I don't. This is stupid. Can we quit? Is there a reverse Uno?
Nope.
Is there a skip card that I can throw down?
Nope. You have to sit in it with me.
Is this how you feel when I give cases?
Yes, it's awful. It's awful. He was not raped or fondled, but he was inappropriately touched to where it made him feel very, very, very uncomfortable. And he like bolted out of that situation. By King's senior year of high school, he was drinking. He was working more than going to school, right? I mean, he's making money. He's working construction, you know, things like that.
Well, if dad's an alcoholic, then dad's probably blowing most of the money he makes on his addiction. And so now it's up to the boys to take care of the household.
Correct. Absolutely.
Okay.
So he drops out his senior year. He gets married to his girlfriend, Dee Dee. And I mean, this thing just feels like a very stereotypical, you know, what you would think of growing up in South Central LA with an abusive father, being misdiagnosed as special education. Like, this thing, like, cards are just stacked against this dude.
It's like a perfect storm.
It is. It is. Yeah. And so at 18, King is a high school dropout. He's married, and he also has his first criminal conviction, which is reckless endangerment. So
do we know what he was, like, what that entailed?
He was just driving drunk type of thing, you know, just.
Yeah.
And he was 18, and they just kind of slapped him on the wrist, you know, like it wasn't anything major, right? So by 1989, so within, you know, another 4 or 5 years, King would be convicted a second time of breaking the law, but this time it was assault and robbery, or so he pled guilty to.
Ooh.
Yeah.
What is that face and that tone?
Yeah. So King, he's pretty much a full-blown alcoholic at this point, right? He's drinking a lot. He doesn't have a lot of work because he does construction work. And he goes into a convenience store and he was like, I'm going to go in, I'm just going to steal it. And then I'm just going to go home. And
the whole store?
Well, you know, steal what he needs from the store. Yeah. I'm going to put the whole store in my car.
My backpack.
And I'm going to go. But then he decides, no, I'm not going to steal it. You know, I'm going to go up to the counter and I'm going to, you know, pull out a pack of gum. And he was like, and I asked the store owner if I could pay for my groceries with food stamps. He was like, I had about $5 of food stamps on me. And the Asian grocery owner says, no, you're not going to do that. And King kind of gets mad and the grocery owner gets mad and they kind of start having a verbal altercation.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the two get into an argument. The store owner pulls out a tire iron and tries to hit King with it. King falls back into like a display of those little mini pies, like the Mrs. Baird pies,
yeah,
and chucks that at him and then just dashes out, gets in his car and drives off. Well, there was somebody there at the gas station or the convenience store. They took down King's license plate and turned it into the police, assuming that King had robbed the store and then run off, right?
Okay.
So
okay.
The store owner would state that it was actually King who assaulted him with a tire iron and robbed and, you know, and stole from him. And so when the police go to question King, mm-hmm. King falsely confesses to his accusations of assault and robbery. And his reason was, quote unquote, I didn't have the money to hire a good lawyer.
So I'm just going to say, yep, do my my little time, you know, get out in however many days, weeks, months.
Right.
This is a lot like what Dr. A was talking about as far as false confessions.
Exactly. He was like, I didn't want to deal with it. I knew I didn't have the money for it. So I was just like, yeah, I can't fight this thing. You know, so yeah, I did it. Whatever.
Interesting.
So because of it, King was sentenced for 2 years in prison, but he was able to get out after 1 year because it was essentially like, even though it wasn't his first conviction, it was like his first major conviction.
Yeah.
So he gets out after 1 year, he's on parole, right? And that is where March 3rd, 1991 comes into play.
Oh, so he got out and he was on parole.
He was on parole.
Okay.
So while still on parole in the early hours of Friday, March 3rd, King, along with his two friends, Bryant Pooh Allen and Freddie Helms, decide to take a drive in King's Hyundai after they had been spending the night just, you know, watching the basketball game and drinking, right? So,
which is what a lot of people and friends do.
Right. Yeah. They've been up watching the basketball game. It's, you know, like midnight type of thing, early hours of the morning, Friday, March 3rd. And they were like, hey, the LA streets are not as busy at this time of night. Let's take a drive, you know, whatever. So I got a lot of my information from this journalist named Lou Cannon. And let me tell you, like Lou Cannon kind of saved my sanity on trying to get through this case. So shout out to Lou Cannon for his work on this case. So while King and his two buddies are speeding down LA's highway, we have two highway patrol officers, Melanie and Tim Singer, it was a husband and wife team, and they were patrolling the streets together.
Is that like allowed?
That was my first question. I was like,
maybe back then, I imagine they have put some sort of like policies in place that like spouses aren't on like the same shifts together.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't know, but they were straight up in their patrol car patrolling the streets. Again, they were highway patrol, and they see King speed by in his white Hyundai sedan, and they begin chasing King, of course, with their lights flashing. And they would later report that his speeds were up to like 115 miles per hour, which, I mean, his little car actually can't go that fast, but
like literally they couldn't drive that fast back then.
Like his little car literally can't go that fast. So that's kind of like the first discrepancy as far as like the reporting goes. Like his car can't even go that fast, but whatever. So this chase would go on for another 8 miles. So Rodney, you know, King sees the flashing lights. He knows that he's being chased, but he goes on for another 8 miles.
And he's intoxicated, right?
He's intoxicated, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so during this time, so Melanie Singer is driving the car and her husband, Tim, at this point is calling for backup, right? This car isn't slowing down. You know, he won't pull over. Kind of like resisting arrest.
Almost. Yeah, like nothing out of the ordinary so right. far. As yeah, far let's... as calling for backup, he's not pulling over. This is a right. high-speed chase at this point.
Right. So he calls for backup. And this backup would include a total of 27 peace officers and a police helicopter.
27 peace officers?
Now, there are 27 officers involved with this chase and a helicopter at this point. I don't know.
I don't understand. Okay.
Maybe. Okay. I don't. I know.
Okay. You seen that Kevin Hart? Have you watched Kevin Hart stand-ups?
A little bit.
So he does a lot of like, okay. And that's all I can do is just be like, okay.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, okay, whatever.
Okay.
King finally pulls over, brings the vehicle to the stop, and Tim Singer, again, he's highway patrol. He's the first one out. He approaches the car, tells all three members of the car, people in the car, to get out. He instructs all three men to get out of the car. Allen and Helms comply, and Tim Singer would attend to them, right? He kind of takes them out. King stays in the car. King's not getting out of the car. So then Melanie, she gets out, and then she starts demanding for King to get out of the car. Again, this is all protocol, right? Like, this is not surprising to anybody. We're going good.
Minus the potentially 27 peace officers.
I mean, minus all of that. But maybe...
But as far as, like, this play-by-play, it sounds, you know...
Right. So, King gets out of the car, and he's laughing, he's giggling, and he's even waving at the cop helicopter, right? The police helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
As Melanie Singer is commanding him to, of course, show his hands and get down on his stomach. Again. Now, remember, we said there were 27 peace officers involved. Some of them would end up leaving. They were just kind of looking at what was going on. But 14 of them would end up staying and become what was referred to as the bystander cops when this thing finally goes to trial. So they're just standing back and they're watching.
And that includes Melanie and Tim Singer.
Correct.
14.
Right.
Okay.
Well, there were 14 plus the additional others. So...
Okay.
There were 14 bystander cops, and then there would be four LAPD, so Los Angeles Police Department, that would soon get involved in this case. So the four officers that actively get involved on the scene are Lawrence Powell, Timothy Wind, Theodore Brisno, and they were under the command of Sergeant Stacy Kuhn.
Okay.
So Powell, Wind, Brisno, and Kuhn.
Is Stacy... Like our Uncle Stacy, is it male or is it female?
Uncle Stacy is a male.
Okay.
So at one point, King grabs his butt, okay? And that makes the officers think that he's reaching for a weapon. Okay. So this motion prompts Melanie Singer to then draw her gun. Because at first it was just like, I need you out of the car. I need you to show me your hands. But when he puts his hand back to grab his butt, because again, he's laughing, giggling, all this stuff. He grabs his butt. She draws her gun out. And then becomes more forceful, you know, telling him, get on the ground now. Show me your hands. Get on your stomach. Okay?
Yeah.
She has her gun drawn. He complies. He gets on the ground, and she's moving towards him. And then she would later state that she hears another voice behind her, which would end up being Sergeant Kuhn. He's now pulling rank and tells her, stand back. We'll handle this. So she knows that he has rank. She complies. She does what she's supposed to do. She pulls back.
Okay.
And so now Sergeant Stacy Kuhn comes in. Okay. So as Kuhn sees it, the California Highway Patrol officer was injecting a gun in a situation that didn't require a lethal weapon. So that's why he tells her to pull back.
Okay.
That was what he says. And the LAPD officers are taught not to approach a suspect with a drawn gun. And that Melanie Singer's tactic was a quote-unquote lousy tactic.
Okay.
So just to kind of quickly run down the LAPD's use of force. So level one, you have physical presence. Okay, just being there. Hey, we're here. You need to get right. Number two is verbalization. Hey, we're telling you, get down, comply with what we're saying. Number three is swarming. So that's like all of them going and trying to subdue the perpetrator.
Okay.
Number four is using the taser, you know, tasing them with a taser. Excuse me. Number five is then using batons. And then if all else fails, number six is using lethal force like a gun.
Okay.
Okay. So that's why he was saying she's kind of skipping steps. We need to do other things before we draw guns.
And this, and Melanie worked for the Highway Patrol. She was not LAPD, so they probably had different protocols.
Correct. Correct. Kuhn would later say, had she proceeded, either she was going to shoot Rodney King or he was going to take her gun away and shoot her. So again, that's kind of his mindset in the moment, right? Mm-hmm. So Kuhn orders the police officers who were watching King to holster their weapons, right? And then he tells the four LAPD officers, Lawrence Powell, Timothy Wind, Theodore Brisno, and then also Rolando Solano was also on the scene. So he tells all four of them to surround King and to swarm him, quote unquote, swarm him by jumping on his back.
Which is the fifth level protocol.
Correct. That's level three. Swarming is level three.
Oh, swarming is level three. Okay.
Swarming is level three. At Kuhn's command, the four officers jump on the fallen King. King's on his stomach. Powell and Brisano grab his arms while Wind and Solano take his legs. Powell keeps his knee on King's back, trying to force his arm back to cuff it. The officers would go on to tell investigators that King would then try to run, shaking all four officers off. This action would confirm that what the officers were suspicious of, and that was that King was dusted. Do you know what dusted?
So he was high on PCP.
That he was high on PCP.
Mm. Which makes you, it's a lot like meth. It can give you kind of, subhuman strength, a lot of erratic behavior.
Correct.
Along with your frontal lobe being shut down and, yeah.
Yes, all the things. And LAPD had been, they'd been taught about this. They had been trained on what to do if a perpetrator is using PCP, all of those things because of what you said. So Kuhn would then order Wind and Solano to stand back. Powell and Brisno were already back. And Kuhn would then fire his taser into King's back, which again, that's level four is firing that taser. After swarming, you fire the taser.
So far, it sounds like
we are going by the books.
We're going by the book right now.
Yeah.
And it is confirmed. Well, I guess that's the whole kind of confusing part about this case is that he said, she said, and the narratives written by the officers involved. But did Rodney King, he had four grown men on him and he shook them off and was able to mobilize his body?
Correct.
Okay. Do we know for sure if he was on PCP at the time?
And that's literally, like, I have a statement in here and that says he was not on PCP. He was drunk, but he was not on PCP. And what's really sad is in his book, Rodney King talks about it. And he was like, I think I became so accustomed to pain because his dad used to beat him with a extension cord. His dad would have him go up and get in a bath, like strip down, get in a bath, and then come downstairs while he was still wet and beat the living crap out of him with an extension cord.
Well, and that makes sense. And if you think about it, alcohol is a depressant, right? And it essentially slows and calms everything down. And that's why a lot of times drunk drivers live in accidents, but people who are not intoxicated will die because they stiffen up. And that's what snaps this and snaps that.
Right.
But when you're intoxicated, you don't have the same reflexes.
Right.
And the pain doesn't affect you the same way.
Right.
So that makes, I mean, that tracks.
Again, all of this is tracking, it's all making sense.
On both sides. Yeah.
Right.
So far.
So far. So, like I said, Kuhn fires the taser and he hits King in the back. King goes down, but then gets right back up. And Kuhn then fires a second taser and hits him in the chest.
So he turned around?
Mm-hmm. He turned around and he faced Kuhn, and Kuhn shot him a second time with the tasers in the chest.
Okay.
Okay. Now, this is where George Holliday comes into this case.
Who's Jorge?
George Holliday was living in the apartments across the street from where King stopped his Hyundai, right? So when he finally came to a stop, the lights, the helicopter, the shouting, all of that wakes him up. He goes to the window to watch all this stuff happening, and he decides that he's going to grab his brand new Sony Handycam video recorder, 1991 style.
What? And so this is where the footage comes in.
This is where the footage comes in.
Okay. So it was a bystander. It was not a media entity. This was just a civilian.
Just some dude in an apartment who's like, oh man, I just bought this camcorder.
I wonder if he sold that footage for money.
We'll talk about that. Mm. So Holiday starts recording right when Kuhn orders Pal and Wind to start delivering the power strokes with their aluminum batons. So now we are at level 5. Level 5 is the use of the PR-24 metal batons.
Again, can you imagine how much that would hurt to be hit with a metal baton?
Let me just tell you, not only are you getting hit with a metal baton, these things are like, you know how you'll have like the grips, kind of like that diamond shaped grips? Those are laser cut into these batons. Like these things are.
I stubbed my pinky toe and I think it's going to wipe me out for eternity.
Oh, I'm dead. Update my will. I'm dead.
Yeah, like don't wake me up for the next 4 hours while I crawl into bed and wallow in my pain. So getting hit with an aluminum or a metal baton.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No, sir. No, ma'am. Mm-mm.
So again, we are in protocol. This is level 5. This is the LAPD's use of force protocol. Okay. The officers would continue to strike King a total of 53 to 56 times. And once King arrived at the hospital after everything was said and done, it would be concluded that he suffered a broken cheekbone, broken teeth, multiple fractures on the right side of his face, lacerations on his forehead, a fractured distal fibula on the right leg, so that's kind of like his ankle area, various bruises, contusions, and abrasions, and then he would go on to suffer permanent brain damage and nerve damage in his leg. And this is where my sentence was, and he tested negative for drugs and was completely unarmed.
They beat the shit out of him. Okay. All right. So we're following protocol.
Uh-huh.
Phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, phase 4, phase 5.
Uh-huh.
At phase 5, we're doing metal batons and giving, what are power strokes? Do you know?
So power stroke is a type of stance and swing that is taught. And it's taught to deliver the most amount of force so that you can hopefully actually like break a bone, you know, like break a leg or break an arm to subdue a person who is resisting arrest. Because it has gotten to that level of they're resisting this.
And so now we have 4 LAPD officers, correct? They're all LAPD.
Okay.
4 LAPD officers in this power stroke stance with metal batons hitting him. And we're talking 54 to 56 times.
Right.
That
but
he was
here's
hit.
Where it gets. This is where you done messed up AA Ron.
Uh-huh.
So during this level 5, officers are instructed to use the baton against the body mass. That means nothing above the shoulders. No head, no neck.
Okay.
And you're supposed to deliver a couple of strikes and then step back and evaluate the situation.
Which, that makes sense, right?
Correct.
Especially if you have an aggressive... I'm not saying that this is the case. I'm just saying if there is an aggressive individual that is, quote unquote, resisting, or they're high on something or whatever the case is, it should be kind of like a maim or an incapacitation. It shouldn't be a...
Exactly.
Like, completely... This sounds like it went from... Like it crossed this threshold and then a frenzy happened.
And then a frenzy happened. It turned into a 7-year-old pinata party.
Yeah. Like, and I know frenzy doesn't cover the extent of his abuse. I don't mean to minimize the damage.
Right.
I just mean like if you drop bait in a piranha tank, there's just this like wild frenzy that happens. And that's what it sounds like.
Correct. And again, you know, like, yeah, they were, you know, needing to get this guy to comply. But that is where, again, that's where the issues come in, is if they had been trained on how to do this power stroke, on how to do these things correctly, it should have incapacitated him quickly. And that was another...
With a couple of strokes, one or two, back away, reevaluate the situation.
Not just, you know, taking the regulator off and just going full blown, like balls to the wall, just unloading on this guy, right? So Pal thought, and he would say that he thought that it landed on King's collarbone, right? And that's what he told investigators.
Oh, God, that's like, still like terrible. Could you imagine getting hit in the collarbone?
Oh, it's terrible. Oh, and not only that, you're supposed to hit them in their joints, like the funny bone area and the knees is where you're supposed to hit. I mean, cause maximum, like to get them down, right?
Yeah.
So Pal told investigators that he had hit King's left arm and possibly his collarbone. Melanie Singer, remember our highway patrol, saw it quite differently. So she was quoted saying, Officer Powell came up to the right side of the driver with his baton out, and he struck him on the right side of the driver's face. Singer said, I saw the blood come out of his face. I heard the driver scream. Recalling the event 2 years later, she said tearfully, there is no doubt in my mind that he hit Mr. King repeatedly in the face. Sorry, guys. Repeatedly in the face, and I will never forget it to the day I die.
Oh, my gosh. And so there are four individuals who are in this level 6 protocol. But this, at this point, this is surpassed.
Right.
And then there are 14 other people watching this.
Just watching. Right. Now we kind of go over to this videotape. Right. So Holiday videotapes it. He goes to bed. He gets up the next morning and it's kind of eating at him. And he's like, I need to do something about this. Like it wasn't sitting well with him.
Yeah.
He said, I thought about what, he thought about what he had seen and decided to tell the police about this videotape. Whoever answered his calls at the Foothill Police Station, and no one at the Foothills Police Station ever acknowledged taking it, wasn't interested.
Well, I mean...
So, disappointed that the police had pretty much hung up on him, Holiday decided to tell CNN's Los Angeles Bureau about the tape.
So, I'm going to try to do the right thing, and I'm going to try to go to the police.
Right.
They say, no, we're not interested. And he says, I have a self-imposed duty to get this out there. So then he goes to the media.
So he goes to CNN, to the CNN's Los Angeles Bureau about his tape. But this would provide another disappointment. For no one was at CNN to take the call. So that was the second step. And then by now, Holiday has... he's convinced that the world needs to see this. So it's one of those weird, and I've been on that mission where it's like the more like roadblocks you get, the kind of the more angry you get where you're like, you know what?
I thought that this was going to be a lot more received,
yeah,
right? Then
yeah, like, this is crazy. I'm now kind of mad about this. So he takes it finally to KTLA, like a local LA station, and he, talks to them, gives it to them, and they agree to take it. So the first event of the incident, as it was recorded by Holiday, is King's charge at Pal. So when they had all swarmed him and he threw them off, that's kind of where Holiday started filming. So they did see him kind of charge towards the officer.
And then he was tased right after that charge?
Correct.
Okay.
So there were 81 seconds of action in this, you know, baton strike, right? Watching them go into, what was that, phase six or phase five of the baton strike. But KTLA edited it and took it down from 81 seconds to 68 seconds. And they cut out King charging at Officer Powell. So what the media is now showing is the 68 seconds of just King being on the ground, getting the living tar beat out of him.
Okay.
It explodes in LA. And then it goes to Chicago, and then it goes to Atlanta and Dallas. And, you know, so within like 2 days, it is literally everywhere.
It is all over the nation. Yeah.
Everybody in the nation is tuned in to what looks like just a full blown, which it was. It was a full blown beatdown of a African-American and, you know, intoxicated. Yes.
I mean, with four officers and 14 standing around.
And then 14 other guys standing around. So the police chief, go figure, was out of town when this all goes down. So when he comes back into the office, the tape is waiting for him.
Oh, my gosh.
And he said that he watched that tape probably 25 times. And then he went on to say, to see my officers engaged in what appeared to be excessive use of force, possibly criminally excessive, to see them beat a man with their baton 56 times, to see a sergeant on scene who did nothing to seize control was something I never dreamed I would witness.
Can I just say, and this, I hope this doesn't sound too messed up, but can I just say that it kind of makes me relieved or happy or grateful, I don't really know the word yet, that the police chief recognizes this?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that sometimes, because these cases present a lot of emotion, right? These are very viscerally challenging cases. Mm-hmm. And I think that sometimes people have a tendency to think in an all or nothing, very black or white kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
It, like in general, I think a lot of humans think that way. And then when you have this kind of intense emotional rush, it can really further polarize those opinions or those thoughts or those perspectives. But I think it's nice to hear that the police chief, and that is, I mean, he is over the LAPD. Those are men and women under his
command. Direction, yep. Maybe direction.
And for him to identify that this was, you said, what was the word? Potentially criminally.
Possibly criminally excessive.
Wow. Because I don't think a lot of times that, if you will, media or whatever presents that other people might also see that this is wrong.
Right.
They paint it in a very like perpetrator versus victim, as opposed to there are perpetrators and there are victims, but there are also a lot of other people.
Correct.
Who kind of make up this dynamic and this balance.
Right. Everybody's watching the video. You know, they're even doing polls and like something crazy. It was like 92% of the people that they polled who watched this, they were like, that's not okay. I mean, right. The nation is like, this is not okay. So the next step is going to be to start prosecuting.
Right.
And originally, they were going to prosecute King for evading police. That was dropped, right? So he was released with no charges. But now they decide that they're going to have to go after the four LAPD officers involved in the arrest. Right? The officers present at the arrest scene, at the intersection of Osborne and Foothill, which is where it happened, were suspended. Okay. So March 7th, Chief Gates announced that the officers would be prosecuted. Okay. And then the next day, March 8th, District Attorney Ira Rainier said that he would seek indictment from a grand jury.
So this is federal now?
So this is federal now. And I always think of nothing can stop me. I'm all the way up. Like he's taken this thing all the way to the top.
Okay.
Within a week, the grand jury, after watching the videotapes and listening to the testimony from King and others, return indictment against officers Kuhn, Powell, Brissino, and Wind. Okay. And that's why, I don't know if you remembered, I threw in another name and he was kind of active, but for whatever reason, they decided that this dude, this Salando officer, didn't need to be involved in it. So
okay.
We're just going to stick with Kuhn, Powell.
And I imagine it's based off of the video evidence, based off of, okay.
Right.
So they're indicting these four officers who were engaging in the level 6 baton procedure that transitioned to beating the hell out of somebody.
Correct. And the charge is assault and use of excessive force.
Force. Okay.
Right. Do you remember when we were talking about catalysts for the LA riots?
Yes.
Very rarely do you have just one. And
okay.
I debated on talking about this, but all of the research into what led into the LA riots included one other case as being a component.
I didn't know that. I thought it was simply this Rodney King situation.
Yeah. Now, this is where I get emotional and also even more angry. The Rodney King case doesn't sit well with me. And I hate to present it like this, but wait until you hear this crap.
Oh.
So we're in the midst of all of this. We're still in the month of March. On March 16th, 1991, We had a
storm. So this is like a week later.
Literally, and right in the middle of all this. A storekeeper, Soon Ja Do, shot and killed 14-year-old Latasha Harlins in the back of the head.
I'm going to need a lot of context for this. Like,
it's 10 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday, March 16th. Harlins enters the store. Do observes Harlins putting a $1.97 bottle of orange juice in her backpack. Do concluded that Harlins was about to steal that and didn't have any money. And so Do claims that she asked Harlan if she was going to pay for that orange juice, which again, you know, like,
you think you're a shopkeeper, it's your livelihood. There's a girl that you think is stealing orange juice. Hey, are you going to pay for that? That sounds pretty, you know, middle of the road.
Yeah. And so then Do claimed that Harlan responded by saying, "What orange juice?" That's her side of it. The problem is we have two eyewitnesses. 9-year-old is Molly and his 13-year-old sister Lakeisha that disputed this claim, saying that Do didn't ask her anything, just immediately starts accusing Harlan of trying to steal, and then, you know, just saying that she was going to walk out with this orange juice. And so Do and Harlan, you know, they get into a tussle type of thing. They get into a verbal, and then they kind of grab each other's shirts type of thing over this orange juice. They have all of this on the videotape, the surveillance camera in the shop. Harlan puts the orange juice down on the counter, turns, walks out, goes to walk out of the store. Do comes from behind the counter and shoots her in the back of the head.
Why? I don't.
And what was in this girl's hand? What was in the girl's hand?
Money to pay for it.
$2.
Oh my gosh.
$2.
You guys go ahead and click unsubscribe right now, because we're just going to cry the rest of this episode, because I cannot deal with this.
Yeah. So she shoots her in the head. It kills her instantly.
She's 14 years old. This baby. This sweet little baby. I'm sure she had an attitude, but 14-year-old doesn't have an attitude. And especially if you come out talking out the side of your mouth saying that you're stealing orange juice. And she's like, bitch, I got $2 in my pocket.
I got $2 right here. So, are you ready? Don't worry. Don't worry, Bailey. It gets worse.
This is like a bad Billy Mays OxyClean commercial.
That's terrible.
Like, one's not enough, but wait, there's more. Two for the price of one. Like, this is not. Nobody needs two tubs of Clorox bleach, and nobody needs two cases of this stuff. This is the worst.
I think excessive is the word. It's like, what's the word on the street? Sesame Street. Excessive. Ready for Do's conviction? Do was convicted of voluntary manslaughter, and the jury recommended the maximum sentence of 15 years. But Judge Joyce Carlin decided against prison time and sentenced Do to 5 years of probation, 400 hours of community service, and $500 instead.
I would be so, I don't know the words, if I was in that community and a 14-year-old girl walked into a gas station to buy a bottle of orange juice, she gets in a little, you know, a little verbal altercation.
Yeah.
She puts the orange juice on the counter. She walks out of the store and the store owner shoots her in the back of the head and kills her.
Mm-hmm.
And she gets 5 years of probation and a fine.
And I'm just going to say it as many times as I can. And the girl had $2 in her hand. It wasn't like, well, maybe she was going to pay for it. It was in her hand.
Did they find her? Did they find her laying there in her hand?
They found her laying on the floor in a pool of blood with $2 in her hand. So relations between tension starts really getting heavy between the African-American and the Korean community now. Because remember, the three communities that were involved were South Central, Pico Union, and what they dubbed as Koreatown.
Okay. Okay.
And so you have the Rodney King issue that's going on. You have this issue where the Korean store owner is literally, I don't even know if you would call it a slap on the wrist. I don't even, anywho.
Yeah.
So things are just getting more.
I mean, talk about not feeling safe in your community.
Right.
Right? Like the, yeah.
So the state appeals court later unanimously upheld Judge Carlin's sentencing decision in April of 1992, a week before the riots. So they pretty much were like,
oh,
no, she wasn't in the wrong. Okay.
I did not know that. I had no idea that this was a part of this kind of dynamic.
It's so complex. So we're going to switch back over to kink. Okay. So the district attorney, the grand jury, you know, they're like, yes, we're moving forward on this thing. You know, we are going to be charging the four officers with assault and the use of excessive force. So attorneys for the four officers focus their attention on moving the trial out of the LA County. So they're like, we'll have this trial, but we're not going to have it in LA County where it actually happened.
Did they say why?
Because it's just going to bring too much, you know, it's going to be too much conflict. There's going to be too much, you know, noise over this thing. We want it moved, right?
They'd probably have to put like gag orders on the jury, right?
I don't know. I mean, they're just like, we don't want it here. So the prosecutors seemed relatively unconcerned about the defense motion for a change of venue. On May 16th, trial judge Bernard Kamens denies that motion. So Judge Kamens is like, no, we're keeping it here in LA. It happened here in LA. We're keeping it here in LA. So, okay. You know, it's kind of like, hey, this is good for King. This is going to be good. But then Judge Kamens done messed up. Aaron.
What is going on?
I know. So a key victory for the defense came in July when the California Court of Appeals unanimously granted their change of venue motion and removed Judge Kamens from the case on account of bias. The court's removal of the judge was based on an ex parte, and that's a legal term, for a message he had sent to prosecutors saying, don't panic, you can trust me. So it doesn't really matter what all of that means. What matters is you can't do that as a judge. You cannot send a, like, fold up your piece of notebook paper into, like, the little origami heart.
Like football triangle that you kick across the classroom. And, like, kick it over to the prosecutors and be like, hey, my guy, I got you, fam.
Right. You cannot do that. Right. So the case is reassigned to Judge Stanley Weisberg. And more good news for the defense came in November when Judge Weisberg decides to schedule the trial in Simi Valley. If you're not from California, that doesn't mean anything to you. But if you are from California, you would understand that that area is a conservative, predominantly white city, right in the middle of Ventura County, and it's also very, very pro-police.
And we're not, to be clear, we're not hating on pro-police.
No, and I was just about to say, the reason why that is upsetting is because
it's a case having to do with police brutality.
It is. It is.
If this were about, you know, a 16-year-old shoplifting or, you know, like, stealing his mom's credit card, okay.
Right.
But when you have a very racially
charged case
situation,
that is not okay. To me, it needs to stay in LA. Like, it shouldn't have been moved. If it had been moved, I feel like it should have been a lateral move to an area that had similar demographics, similar,
like, socioeconomic status.
Because I feel like that is just. I feel like that is right. Okay.
And if I had to guess, I would imagine that the majority of the jury selected, because it's pulling from Simi Valley, that the majority of the individuals were Caucasian.
So, yes. So the majority of the people that were pulled, they were Caucasian. There were a total of 5 African-American people that were pulled, but 4 of them denied. They said, I don't want to do this. I'm opting out. There was one African-American who did not make it onto the jury. But you end up getting a jury of 12. There were 9 white members, 1 Hispanic American, 1 Asian American, and 1 biracial member for this case. So
75% is a white jury.
Correct. And this is why I really, really hate this case, because I don't want this to be a racially charged podcast, right? But again, those are just the facts. That's just what happened, right?
Well, sure. And I think even if we were looking at it from a different, I think the issue here is that there were the accusations are of 4 white police officers. There is assumptions or narratives in the media that this is a racially charged crime.
Right.
And I'm not saying that white people cannot be unbiased, but you're more likely to have biases in this kind of dynamic than you would, like you said, going to a place that has a little bit more diversity, like you had with the Los Angeles and that kind of thing.
Right. They go through the whole court trial, and honestly, we could do a whole nother episode on just the court trials, right? Like on the court case and the testimonies and all of that stuff. But the end result was, after 7 days of deliberating and hearing all the testimonies and examining the videotape, they come to a verdict. On April 29th, 1992, the 7th day of the jury deliberation, the jury acquitted all 4 officers of assault and acquitted 3 of the 4 of using excessive force. So all guys were acquitted. Everybody involved was acquitted. 3 of them were acquitted for both. And they had a hung jury on Officer Powell. He was the one that really kind of was doing the most unethical things. A quick thing about Powell is Officer Powell did an MDT message. So like an in-car, like an official message to another officer. And he said, quote, "I haven't beaten anyone this bad in a long time." And
this was in his official report.
Yes. And then during trial, they asked Officer Powell to demonstrate this power stroke, and he could not demonstrate it appropriately. Like he is so pretty much showing like he was not trained. He was not, and I guess kind of, I don't know, since we are, I don't know if we want to include this in it. So Powell was kind of the problem officer for the defense, right? Mm-hmm. He was a 3-year veteran of the LAPD, and he had been called upon to, at roll call, to demonstrate power strokes with his metal baton, and had performed poorly enough to have been singled out for inefficient use of his weapon. And his ineffective technique was also in evidence in his performance as the lead officer in the King arrest. He was described as even sadistic a lot of times from his fellow officers. He was always throwing out racial slurs. Other officers called Powell immature, sexist. And then at one point, Los Angeles had settled 1 excessive force claim against Powell for $70,000. So he had a little bit of a history.
And this is also what is being exposed to, like what is also exposing the situation throughout this trial process is this is not his first time.
Correct.
There's a lot of other problematic behaviors involved, and yet there's still an acquittal.
And not only is there acquittal, now Chief Gates, remember, he had said like that was an excessive use of force, that was criminal, yada yada, but he would not acknowledge that there were problems within his LAPD. And that's kind of what people got so upset over is like.
But that's so terrifying, right? Like if we were to look past the anger and look underneath that at the fear, because usually there's fear beneath anger. If there is a very powerful force,
right,
and the LAPD arguably is a powerful force. I mean, law enforcement arguably is a powerful force. And you have the situation with excessive
force, use of force.
Mm-hmm. Force. And the police chief is essentially saying, yeah, so cool, this happened, but there's really nothing wrong with how we do things. That is the scariest thing. And because, I'm going to leave it that.
I know. Mm-hmm. And that really had, that was kind of that key point was like, if it had just been said, this is wrong. It was excessive force. We have some issues and we need to reexamine our LAPD.
And we'll take accountability for our pieces of this, right?
I think this whole thing would have come out differently.
Okay.
Because that was a lot of it. So
the rioting didn't happen because of the excessive force of Rodney King. The rioting came after the acquittal and the denial from the police chief at the LAPD that there wasn't essentially anything wrong.
Right. And this is another thing that's so crazy to me. So everybody has their TVs turned on, right? Like everybody in the community is waiting on bated breath for this verdict. The residents of the communities of LA received the news of the acquittal at 3:15 on April 29th. By 3:30, there were more than 300 people gathering and protesting the verdict at the LA courthouse. So even though it wasn't held at the LA courthouse, they were there protesting.
Yeah, well, it's a representation of the judicial system.
By 4:58, Mayor Tom Bradley, in response to the quickly increasing violence and rioting, urged the communities to stay calm. So he's making official announcements at this point. And he was quoted saying, "Today, this jury told the world that what we all see with our own eyes wasn't a crime. Today, that jury asked us to accept the senseless and brutal beating of a helpless man. Today, that jury said we should tolerate such conduct by those sworn to protect and serve. My friends, I am here to tell this jury, no. No, our eyes did not deceive us. We saw what we saw. What we saw was a crime. We must not endanger the reforms we have achieved by resorting to mindless acts. We must not push back progress by striking back blindly."
And who said this?
So this was Mayor Tom Bradley. So the LA's mayor at the time.
Okay. All right.
Which I thought was a brilliant, I thought that was a brilliant speech of like, yes, this is not okay.
But at this point, people aren't.
No.
At this point, your words don't mean a lot because we heard words that we were going to have indictments for these officers, that we were going to address the excessive use of force, that we were going to address the murder of Latasha Harlins, and then the justice system that everybody is saying leave it up to comes back and says,
yeah, it's all right.
It's okay. It's all right.
They were having a bad day. So sorry.
Well, yeah. And this is, I imagine, just generational and decades of just kind of layering it and layering it and layering it of judicial, impartial, all of it, right? Whatever I'm trying to say for years and years in a lot of different scenarios, and not just law enforcement versus civilians. I mean, across the board.
We're now pretty much at the end, which was the beginning, right? So that's April 29th, the day that the riots start.
I always think of the Sublime song when I hear that. April 29th, 1992.
So now, just in case anybody is curious, we do kind of have the aftermath of all of this stuff. There was a second trial for the four officers who were acquitted on February 25th, 1993. And so it was in the Los Angeles courtroom of District Judge John G. Davies. The Department of Justice assembled a formidable team of four prosecutors to try the closely watched case. The lead prosecutor on the team was 34-year-old Stephen Clymer, and he was considered to be the best trial lawyer in the U.S. Attorney's Office in L.A. The federal jury was racially mixed, so it was more proportionately distributed. Judge Davies decided to postpone the announcement of the verdict until 7 a.m. the next morning to minimize the danger of rioting, kind of like we want to make sure that we have everything in place. And then the verdict was the jury found two of the officers, Kuhn and Powell, guilty, and they acquitted officers Wind and Brazino. So they essentially found Kuhn and Powell guilty. Kuhn of like not supervising that situation, not taking better control of it, and then Powell for using excessive force. And Judge Davies sentenced Kuhn and Powell to 30 months in federal correctional camps. So it did end up doing serving time in a federal correctional camp for that.
What is a correctional camp?
Huh?
What is a correctional camp?
So I believe in LA, like in Rodney King's book, he actually talked about when he was sentenced that he went to this correctional camp. And it was like, he said it was actually really amazing because they like were teaching him trades. I don't want to say it was a hard labor. It wasn't a hard labor camp, but apparently it's like a camp setting, but they okay. have you do duties and things like that. I would have to research that a little bit more, but King actually said that he really enjoyed because he was able to work. He didn't have access to any alcohol, so he was able to sober up while he was there, and it was it was really good for him. So the Los Angeles mayor, Tom Bradley, now over to King, offered King $200,000 and a 4-year college education funded by the city of Los Angeles, okay, to kind of compensate for things that had happened. King refused and went on to sue the city and was subsequently awarded $3.8 million. King continued to have run-ins with the law, and he would say in 2012 that he had been arrested perhaps 12 times since 1992. And King actually died later that year in 2012 from an accidental drowning. And when they did the autopsy report, they did find PCP and alcohol in his system. So he struggled with addiction.
He struggled with addiction.
And with run-ins with the law for the rest of his life.
And arguably, just again, as an addiction therapist, likely a contributing factor to the run-ins with the law, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, and you have to remember, he suffered permanent brain damage because of this. His damage was so bad that he wasn't allowed to testify at his own trial because of the brain damage. Like, because
they were afraid of what he would say.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
So, and with that being said, I don't want to take away from, like I said, I downloaded Rodney King's book, The Riot Within, and I've been reading through it. But they did talk about, other sources talked about, like, Rodney's stories changed all the time on what happened, you know, his, but again, that correlates with a traumatic brain injury.
With it, yeah.
You know?
And substance use.
Right.
I mean, yeah. It doesn't necessarily mean that he's, you know, and I'm trying to be as fair as I can. That doesn't necessarily mean that he's being malicious about the intention
Correct.
Of changing his stories, but it could be, they, you know, it could be a lot of other underlying things for
right.
that.
So, do I think that Rodney King was a stand-up guy, was somebody who needed to be martyred, was just, you know, the poster child of how a person should be, live their life, yada, yada? No. Rodney King talks about it in his book as well, where he was like, look, I didn't do the right thing. I made mistakes. I didn't do this correctly, but so did they.
Yeah.
And I think at the end of the day, this is not a, you know, Rodney King was this amazing guy and this shouldn't have happened to him. It is nobody. This should happen to nobody. You should not have your teeth knocked out of your face, your occipital bones broken, and skull fractures.
And be left with a traumatic brain injury.
And be left with a traumatic brain injury because peace officers are using excessive force or not trained correctly, right?
Yeah.
Like, I am pro the right thing. This was not the right thing. They did not follow protocol. They did not do what they were supposed to do. At one point, there was also like stomping. They were stomping Rodney King. That also is against protocol.
No.
So my point is, protocols are set in place for a reason, to keep people safe. When you go off of that, when you disregard those protocols, this is what happens.
And you're also jeopardizing the trust with the community.
You're also jeopardizing the trust with the community. And to come full blown, full circle, that is why I love what you guys are going to be hearing with our interview with Dr. Penn on Friday. Is instead of saying, look, it happened, the shoe dropped, we'll try to clean it up the best we can, his approach is, how are we going to make it so that this doesn't happen? How are we going to build relationships? How are we going to increase our cultural competency, our trust, our education, so that we don't have another situation like this?
And this is why I think that this is a really great case that you chose for the interview with Dr. Penn.
Yeah.
Even though Rodney King was, you said he was like 24, 26.
Right.
Or something.
Yeah, he wasn't a minor.
He wasn't a teenager.
No.
But it does speak to the kind of ongoing unrest,
yes,
right, that we've experienced.
Correct.
And I just want to, maybe I'm validation seeking from our listeners, but I want you guys to know, I hope y'all are really proud of us for doing a case like this, because Chelsea and I both, I do not talk about this stuff in a public platform,
y'all,
ever.
I hate
this
it.
This is so hard. I avoid this stuff like the plague, because as you'll hear me say in Dr. Penn's interview, my husband, whom I love very dearly, was in law enforcement for years. Most of the clients that I've worked with for the majority of my population have been underdogs, whether it was, you know, from a socioeconomic status, a racial status, or whatever the case is. And so my heart pretty much equally lies on both sides of this fence.
Yes.
And one of the things that Dr. Penn will talk about is, you know, why can't you be both? Why can't you, you know, like, it shouldn't have to be Black Lives Matter versus Blue Lives Matter, or, you know, or whatever phrases you want to put in there. I'm not touching that with a 10-foot pole.
No.
I am just saying that these are tough cases to do in a rational way and without people getting so viscerally charged from it that they start attacking, well, you guys sounded like you were too far this direction, or you guys sounded like you were too far that direction. And it takes a lot, right? It's a lot to be able to balance this whole, something like this that's so significant and so hard out. So thank you so much for presenting this case. I really hope that we don't have to do this anymore.
No. Well, and you know what? As ironic as it is, in the words of Rodney King, can we just get along? Can we please just get along? Which, say what you will about that. Being that person, being like that peacekeeping personality, I am like, yes, Mr. King, can we please just get along?
I hope the individuals that were involved in this get the help and healing that they need all the way around. Nobody hates a bad cop more than a good cop.
Yeah. But right. I want to apologize. I just have so many emotions. But yeah, guys, thanks for sitting through this with us.
Yeah.
And I wish I could tell you that I hated this with every fiber in my being.
But this is true crime, right? Like, this is very relevant, very important stuff. This isn't just about, you know, serial killers or, you know, break-ins. Crime is multidirectional, and it's on such a big spectrum. And this is such an important part of true crime. And we would be hypocritical if we did not cover things. As much as we hate to do it, we have an obligation to use our platform for advocacy in every way possible.
Correct. I'm going to close this with reading you from Rodney King's book. This is my closing statement. I have been asked countless times if I've forgiven those officers for beating me. The short answer is yes. The long answer is that I work on it every day, and every day I let it go a little more. I know I did wrong that night, and I believe they did wrong too. But we all have to move on and let go of the hate.
And with that, we appreciate you guys for tuning in and hanging out with us through this wild ride. And we will catch you
on the flip side.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Hey, Wildside Tribe, don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Wildside Podcast.
Make sure to tune in on Wildside Wednesdays. New episodes will drop each Wednesday at 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
We would love to hear from you, so if you have a wild case recommendation, email us at wildsidepodcast@gmail.com. That's Wildside with a C. Or share your thoughts in the comments below.
As always, if you haven't heard it today, you're loved, you're worthy, and you're valuable. And we'll catch you on
the flip side.